Hey everyone, welcome back to The Screenwriting Life. I'm Meg LaFauve. Lauren can't be here today, and I know she's totally bummed because we've been so looking forward and are thrilled to welcome to the show the co-creator, executive producer, and showrunner of Lopez vs. Lopez, Debbie Wolf. She's a comedy writer and a director who has written and produced for network, cable, and streaming shows, including Whitney, One Day at a Time, and Love, Victor, among others. Hi, Debbie. It's so wonderful to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, we can't wait to chat with you about all your work, but first we're going to talk about our weeks, or what we like to call adventures in screenwriting. I'll go first because it's short and sweet. Well, it's not sweet, but I am on a rewrite for a movie that the notes basically said. So let's say it was a movie about a family on a ski trip with a wolf. And now their notes are literally like, does it have to be about a family? Does it have to be a ski trip? And what about that wolf? And I'm like, this is everything, like everything that was there from your original IP. So, of course, I've just spun into, with my writing partner, a slight ring of hell, because we're trying to use IP that they don't want to use, really, and yet we need to use it. And what I've learned is two important things about myself. One is I cannot compartmentalize when I have anxiety about a story not working. It's not like, well, I'll just put that to bed and I'm not working now, so I won't think about it. I'm waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning with literal thoughts about what I could do or what's not working, even though I'm sleeping. I'm clearly thinking about it in my sleep. Part of my kid, because I'm very tense. Because until the story works, my brain is just going, and I'm sure on a 3-camera, you guys are going so fast. I don't know how you do it. But my anxiety, though, I did also realize a good thing, which is I was beating myself up for this, the fact that I couldn't compartmentalize and that my anxiety was spinning me out. But I did realize, once I found with my writing partner a solution to the problem, I did realize my anxiety was right. Like, the road we were going down to fix it was too big of a shift off of the short story. So my anxiety was right, and beating myself up about it was not helpful.
Yes.
Like, it is a wise part of me. It is an intuitive part of me that is not, it's like, it's not toning right. It's not toning right. Something's not right. I can't intellectually figure it out what that is. But my like tuning fork, my writer tuning fork is like, wait. I mean, we had to go and do all of that in order to find the answer and bring it back to the original. So I'm glad we did that. But I just need to trust myself a little bit more, you know, that to get to that new thing, I'm going to have some anxiety, and I'm going to have to listen to that anxiety and just push.
Absolutely.
Blow it all up. Just let it blow up. And then the next important thing is when you find new stuff, some of which doesn't work, then we had to go back to, okay, what did we originally love about this?
Mm-hmm.
Right? What do we love? Like, sometimes our anxiety is so busy telling us all the stuff that doesn't work that you have to remember where it works is also where in the stuff you love. And by doing that, by taking the stuff we loved, letting it blow up and finding new stuff, we've kind of been able to come back to a middle ground that I think we're actually excited about, which is crazy considering my mental state 2 days ago.
That's the process. That's the
that
process.
Yeah. Right?
I have a very spiritual philosophy that, you know, the universe brings us notes to, you know, push us to write a better script. That's how I always think of it. And, you know, Bruce Helford, who's, you know, legendary comedy writer, he's my mentor. He says, like, he told me, he's like, you can always write a better script. Always. And I always hold that to like heart whenever I get notes that like make me spiral. I'm like, I know this is going to lead me down a better road.
Like, if you can hang in there, right? And you can go on that roller coaster ride that's coming. And a lot of people will then start to blame the executives or the producers that gave you the notes. And I'm always like, that's just too easy. Like, they are experts in this genre, right? Yeah. And while I'm bummed that what they told us to do, they don't want anymore, they also have tuning forks. They also understand things in a deep way. And we can dig in our heels, or we can say, let's try it. We got it.
Yeah.
I mean, we can always come back to what we had, but we got to try throwing it all away in order to come back to what we had. Right. Yeah. So I love that. I love that your philosophy, and I'm going to literally write on a card here over my computer, because who knows what's going to happen today, right, as we go into the story. But you know, it is the notes are the universe, you know, helping you write a better script.
You can always write a better script.
Always write a better script. Oh my God, which gives me some agita. But all right, how
What
was Debbie? How was your week?
I do this week? Wow, I'm like we're right in the middle. So we shot four episodes over 4 weeks. So it's very fast paced. So right now I am in post-production on four episodes. I'm prepping the next three. We're on a hiatus week, meaning that production shut down, but the writers keep working. So I'm prepping the next six, actually, episodes. So three are
My God.
written, three are not written
Oh
yet.
my God.
So we're breaking, yeah, the last three, which shoot in a couple weeks. So every day is an event. Is I'm in different places, you know. Either I'm in the writer's room, or I'm in the edit bay, or I'm in a panic in a ball in my bed. So I'm in all different places at all times. But it's
How do you like, let's say the anxiety, because we're all human beings, right? And the anxiety can sometimes just be overwhelm. I mean, what you just described already put me in overwhelm. How do you stay focused in the middle of all of that?
I don't know. I don't have an answer for you. I think that, last year was very challenging. It was my first time as a showrunner, but we did 22 episodes. So I had no choice but to dive in and just get used to it. And you just get used to the pace. And so now second season, it's like second nature. It feels a lot easier this season, actually, to navigate all of it.
Because you'll know a
Because
little bit more what's coming and what's
is
expected and
exactly. There's no more of a learning curve. The learning curve
right.
was what the hardest thing to navigate. But now that that's gone, that's a big stress relief. But it's a lot. It's a lot to do.
Where do you
Antidepressants help.
get
They
the
certainly.
energy? I mean, do you have in your show, I've heard some shows set up so that they really are trying to keep the writer's room to go home at a regular hour, or do you find with 22 episodes, are there days that you're just like, we're all staying through dinner? Like, how do you balance, or is there just no balance when you're doing 22 episodes?
Well, this season we have 10, so it's a little more manageable. But yeah, I think during production we just like we never go past like I think the latest night we've ever had was like 10 o'clock. Like I don't believe that anything good happens like after the sun sets, actually. Like it's very hard to think. And so and I think I have the skill of making decisions. Like I know how to make decisions, and I'm confident. I have a very clear vision of what the show is, and so I don't hesitate, and I don't try to keep people there later because I just don't think anything good comes of it. And the beauty of multicam is that we get three rewrites. So we'll try to do like the heavy lifting after the table read, but we also know that we have the next day and we have the next day, so we can call it a day and say like, okay, well, we know that this part isn't
Right.
working, but we can take a stab at it tomorrow.
Wow, amazing. I can't wait to hear all the details about this, how this
Yeah.
works, multi-cameras work. Jeff, do you want to jump in and tell us your week?
Yeah, and I also want to just acknowledge something you said, Debbie, that I think is so valuable, which is like, even though it's crazy and the schedule's moving so fast, and this is your second season show running, you know what the show is, and you have a confidence about what the show is. So when you're drowning in notes and edits and writing and posts, and you don't have enough bandwidth to even take a breath, that confidence in at least knowing what the beacon of the show is will help you make decisions. And that's how we need to be with our work, I think. I feel like sometimes it's all we have.
Exactly. Like, yeah, you have to have a level of confidence and delusion to be able
Yeah, definitely.
to be a writer.
Well, I
Oh
love
my
that.
God.
That's a
It's
it, it...
exactly the same as feature writing. You have to be slightly delusional.
Yes.
Yes. But it's nice to like serve something outside of yourself. If you're serving like the story and the overall beacon, it kind of puts you outside of yourself and can orient everyone in the same direction. So I just think that's really valuable.
Yeah, and I have such an amazing team with me too, like it's not just me alone. I have a team of eight writers, and then I have an amazing cast. And I have George Lopez, who is also a muse. So I have just an amazing group of collaborators to help me along the way.
Can't wait to get into it. I'll keep it quick, but in terms of my week, I dusted off a feature that I've been wrestling with for I feel like a decade now because it's very, very close to me. And everyone who reads it is like, this is such a voicey piece. And like, we can feel you on the page, but like, the story just, I've tried to rewrite and re-engineer like the pieces of this thing, and I just haven't quite cracked it. And I had a draft, it's probably like what, 12, I don't know, from last summer. And I felt like great about it then. And I dusted it back off and pulled it out. And I was like, oh, finally I can see with clarity like all these notes I was getting. It's funny how I like had to put it away and like let it dust off before I could actually see that all these notes were right about the story. So that was both like kind of reassuring in that like I have a little more objectivity that I can get back in there, but also kind of upsetting because now I have a lot of work to do. But
Yes, you do. Well, welcome, feature writing. Blow it up.
yes, I need
Yep.
to blow it
Yeah.
up.
I'm
But
interested, Debbie, if you're like, let's say, doing a table read and the notes are coming in, probably, I mean, you're the showrunner, so your notes, of course, are incredibly important. I'm sure the writers have notes, actors could have notes, studio will have notes, network will have notes. You don't have time to wait and dust it off and get perspective, right? Like, you've got to go, right? Like, right now.
No. Yeah, we have to dive right in. I think that's a skill I developed over time too, and through mentorship. I learned how to, figure out how to address the notes and not just completely spiral and blow everything up. Like oftentimes, like notes will be paragraphs long just to like change one line. And so that's like the secret. It's like it's sometimes like people like they feel like they have to ex over explain what the note is, but literally they're asking you for one line of exposition just to clarify something. So that's like a skill that I think you develop as you
You
write more
go.
and more, and as you deal with notes more and more,
And
you
what
realize
are the
like.
stages of getting notes in a three cam? I worked on a TV show, but it wasn't three cam, so I don't know if it's the same. But I remember, there's the break the season, there's the outlining, and you're getting notes every step of the way, correct?
Yes. So we have multiple layers of notes and multiple things. So we start with the story area. That's the first thing. So story area, first it has to be approved by producers. George and Mayan get it. Then it has to be approved by studio, and studio will give notes. And then we goes to network. Network will give notes. And then we'll go to outline. So then there's an outline, and then there's also producers, studio, network. And then we'll go to script, and script also has studio or producer, studio, network. And then we'll do a table read. So we'll have our table draft, and then that table draft also gets noted by producers, studio, network. And then we have two more rewrites after that. We have a studio run through and a network run through. And those also are get notes at all those different levels that I mentioned. So many rounds of notes to get the script
This
to
is
the
why
show.
your show is so good because, I mean, that's amazing. And of course, I love that you have the idea that getting notes makes a script better because you're getting lots of notes a lot of time, right? Like,
But like I said, oftentimes it's like it's a joke here, it's a line here. Like it's not like, we actually have very supportive studio and network, and who just like love the show, and they're just like supportive of what we're doing. So the notes aren't ever insane. And then I'm very critical. Like I'm very critical of the work, and my writers are as well. So we play devil's advocate a lot, and like we question if what we're writing is correct. So oftentimes we know the notes before they're given. We can anticipate what
like
they're
you can,
going to
because you've already been talking about it or wondering about it or
Yeah. Yeah. Bruce Helford does this magical thing where he's an EP on the show, and he'll actually like when the network after the table read, the network and studio come to us, and they'll be like, well, what did you think? And he'll basically tell them their notes before they have a chance to say it. They're like, that's what we were gonna say. It's like he has the magic touch to do that.
That's amazing. Now, a
Yeah.
lot of our listeners, we asked them, what they wanted to, learn from you. And a lot of our listeners really asked about the room, but they asked about both how to get in that room in terms of staffing and as well as what happens in that room. So let's just start with getting in because that would be this one, two, three. So do you staff, do you only staff multicam writers, first of all? Let's just talk about who you look at to get in your room. How do you pick your writers? Are you really just looking for pure comedy writers? Do you ever consider dramedy? Do you read features? Like what's the process of staffing a multicam room?
Yeah, so the first thing is, yes, multicam experience is definitely a plus, but it's not a must. The first thing that I did when I was staffing is, of course, reach out to writers that I've been doing this now for 10 years. I've been in rooms and, collected a large network of writers. And so the first thing I do is reach out to upper level writers, showrunners, and ask, like, who do you like? Who would be good for the show? And so it's a lot of recommendations. So one thing I do say to young people coming up in the business is that any job you take, make sure you leave with a good impression because you don't know where it could lead. So, so we take a lot of recommendations. And then, yeah, I will read, I will read. I would love when people have a multicam sample because it shows me that you understand the format. But it's not, at the lower level, I think it's not as necessary. At the upper level, I do want to know that you can, that you have that multicam, that you've worked in multicams before. But at the lower level, I'm a little more open and flexible. So I will read single cams as well, and then if they have any other material like short films or if they have some stand up, like I'll look at that as well. And the biggest thing that I look for is what is your specific point of view, and does that specific point of view lend itself? Is it similar to the point of view of the characters in the show? Because when you staff a room, you're kind of also like you're basically staffing the characters on your show in your room. Because
Sure.
you want the debates that the characters have on the show, you want those to happen in the room. So I really look for that. And when people come in to interview, I ask them, I'm like, do you relate to any of the characters and why? And and then people will give personal stories. If they have a George in their life, they have a Rosie in their life. They have a Chance. And that's very appealing to me. Like I want to know that like you can write for this show. That
Yeah, that
your
is
point of view will
so
lend
smart.
itself.
Now you mentioned there that sometimes you if you'll look at additional material like a short film. I just want to jump back to you because I know that you also wrote and directed short films. Did you find that was helpful to becoming a writer and breaking into the business? And what was that process like for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I went to film school sort of with the idea that I was going to be this indie feminist filmmaker. I think that's what I definitely like, I made like the dark, brooding female films that everyone
Seems
makes
to
in
be a
film school.
prerequisite. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was my idea, but like, I think that the process of producing my short films, all those skills that I learned in film school, like how to put together a short, and edit it, from pre-production, like I learned about props, costumes, everything, all of those skills I use today as a showrunner. So I think making short films is a great training ground. And so yeah, I think it was fantastic that I did that. And it also the short films that I made in college, one of them ended up playing Tribeca Film Festival and a bunch of other film festivals. And so I got to network and like, one of my first jobs out in Los Angeles came from someone I met at a film festival.
Great.
So I think that the short films can open up a lot of doors
And
for
what was
young
that
writers.
first job? What was that first job you said? Like, how did you come out?
Oh, so I met a PA, I met a production manager of commercials at a film festival, and he hired me as a PA on like Michel Gondry's brother was a commercial director. And it was this insane like stop motion commercial. And basically they tied all the PAs to a car, like we were like a like horses. They tied us to a car and
This
we
is
had to
such a
pull.
Hollywood story.
Yeah, we had to pull the car like inch by inch, so frame by frame, right? Because it was stop motion. And so that was like my first job, and I was so much pain after the day was
My
over because it
God,
was
that's
like,
amazing. Mom, I made
yeah,
it into Hollywood.
I
Yes,
made
I pulled
it.
the car.
I'm a
Oh my God.
horse.
I'm a horse. That's amazing. Oh, that's exp life experience. But you also were in the NBC Writers on the Verge program, right? Was that
Yes.
a helpful springboard?
Oh, absolutely. So, it took me a while to get there. Like, I basically like I had this short film that played all these festivals. I came to Hollywood. I was like, "Hand me a feature, Hollywood. I'm here." But like, that's not how it works. Like, I really had to like work really hard, and I took whatever job I could get. And but all the that entire time that I was like doing different jobs, I worked in casting, I worked in reality TV, I worked in producing web series. I would always apply to programs because that's how I wanted to get, came out to Los Angeles to write and possibly direct. And I would use program deadlines to get stuff done. That's the only way I would get scripts done.
Oh my gosh,
And
that's so
so, yeah, so I would apply and apply and get rejected, got rejected from Sundance, got rejected from all the indie, like I told you, I was on this indie
right, all
film
that indie stuff,
filmmaker. All
right?
the indie stuff, they did not like my material because what I realized is my material was too broad for them. Like it was like too commercial and too funny. It wasn't like as dark, probably was what they were looking for, a niche. And so when the opportunity came up to like write for television, I was like, oh, maybe this is what I'm meant to do.
Yeah.
And I had a short film that played the NBC Diversity Showcase, which they have at the DGA, and I got introduced sort of to the program and the people in the program, and I applied for their writers program. I actually took I and I didn't know how to write television at the time. I didn't know about writers' rooms. I didn't know how it worked,
But I
but
love
I
that
took
you dove in. So
yeah,
good.
I just dove in. Yes, I took a comedy writing course at the Improv Olympic, which no longer exists, but there was a comedy writing course that I took, and I wrote a Modern Family spec. And the way that I approach things is like, I go full in. Like I was like, okay, I'm gonna write a Modern Family. I need to watch every episode, dissect every episode, figure out how it works because, there's structure. Structure is the hardest thing to learn as a writer. But like I broke apart every single episode so I could really understand the science of it. And then I wrote my own Modern Family spec and it was pretty good and it got me into the Writers on the Verge program, which is now NBCU Launch. But back then it was Writers on the Verge and 800 people apply to it, but only 8 get in and I got in and changed my life. Absolutely changed my life. They got me my agent, and they also got me my first staff writing gig on Whitney season 2.
Amazing. Well, and they're lucky. They're lucky to have found you, I will also say.
Thank
You were
you.
lucky to get in, but they were lucky to find you. Look at what you're doing for them now. See, smart program. I love that they're investing in these new voices and people coming up because it's good for the business, it's good for the storytelling. So just
Yeah.
to go
Quickly
back a
ask,
go
just
ahead.
because you mentioned a Modern Family spec, and as you were talking about staffing, we talk all the time on the show about studying your genre, knowing your genre, breaking it down, dissecting it. So you're staying true to the philosophy of our podcast, but it made me think about, as a showrunner, as you're staffing, what's your opinion on like original spec pilots versus spec pilots or spec episodes for shows that already exist?
Yeah, I think different showrunners have different like they want to read different things. So I definitely would have both ready at the ready because you just never know. But for my preference, I want to read original material because like I want to know what your voice is. And that's something that I got out of the NBC program as well is, as writers, we don't think of ourselves as a brand, but you kind of have to in television especially because you need to like your agents and executives and stuff, they need to be able to pitch you and like they need to have like a short version of like who you are as a writer and what your voice is. And so, that's something I got out of it. And so, like, I want to understand that. I want to be able to read someone's script and get who they are, where they come from, what their perspective on the world is, and what's unique about it. So that's why I prefer original material. That's I like original material that's very personal, is what I prefer to read.
And if you were a feature writer, if there's one of our listeners asked about being a feature writer who wants to break into TV, I heard you say you'd read other things, but it still sounds like they need to have a TV sample, really,
Yeah,
if they
I
get
don't
it.
want to read 120 pages.
I know, right? You have so much
I
to read. You have so much to read.
don't have the time to read a feature. So any of you want to write for TV, teach yourself how to write for TV. You should have a sample. You should
Absolutely.
have it.
Now back in, let's walk back into the writer's room. And so, forgive me if this is a very naive question, but I don't know 3CAM. Are you breaking season-long arcs, or are you really finding like the best episodes for what could happen? Is there any like longer arcs, or really it is what's the best, most fun, emotional thing that could happen in this episode?
Yeah, I think we definitely We'll start the season off thinking about where our characters start and where we want them to end up, each character. Because that's how the best storytelling works. Like, you should have arcs. But within that, with multicam, and I think what's fun about the genre is every episode does stand alone, arcs or not. Like, you don't have to watch what happened before or after to enjoy any of the 22 episodes that we have for a season. You can jump right in. But I think it makes it for stronger storytelling if you understand, and then what you're trying to do is build to, like, a really impactful finale so that people want to come back for the next season. So
And
we definitely do think about arcs.
when you're creating those arcs, because somebody spoke to me once who works in TV, and they said that people do want to tune in to see the character behave the way the character behaves, that they're not changing too much. Or do you feel like, for example, you're working with George Lopez, just like you said, your muse, he's amazing. If I'm tuning in to watch his character, do I want him to always be, George Lopez? Or how do you balance that arc with what I'm tuning in to see?
Yeah, I think it's more about, like, yeah, what is his journey? Like, so first season, his journey was, grappling with his alcoholism, and we ended in the finale was him, is an intervention by his family, and then so going into season two, you knew you were going to meet a sober George, but he's still George. Just because he gets sober, you're not a completely different person, and that's kind of what the first episode is about. It's like expectation versus reality, like, what Mayan thought, she thought a sober George is going to be Tom Hanks, but he's actually still Tom Arnold.
Right.
He's still, like, there's still the, like, humans, go through journeys of, major things happen in our lives. We move to different locations, or, we might, go to therapy, or we might do different things in our lives, but we're still at our core the same person. So,
Yeah, amazing.
that's
I
what we
love that
do.
so much. I
Yeah.
really just so smart.
It
Now,
almost feels like, Debbie, like you're approaching the seasons as having a theme in a way. Like season one, and that's kind of an interesting way to think about a multicam season is like if you know you're building to this meaningful finale, that can be like a target for you as you're even building episodes within the season, because they can be even in micro ways addressing that theme that's eventually going to build to that finale. Then for season two, there's that slight push. There's something new that you can explore and kind of build the season around that, even if the episodes stand alone. Is that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, we were just talking today because we're breaking the season two finale today in the room, and we were like, okay, well, what is the what are we setting up for season three? What's exciting to watch and for people to come back and watch in season three? So yeah, we definitely think about that.
And I love your show that you're dealing with something challenging and difficult in terms of the alcoholism. And yet, it's a fun show and it's funny and it's George Lopez. And that you're, it's funny because I do think you are doing your independent girl meaningful work. But in the
Thank
beautiful, beautiful, fun package, it's just so smart, so smart and so admirable. Now, how is it to work together with someone of George Lopez's status, but also smarts, I mean, incredibly talented, smart person. How does that balance in that collaboration, maybe even when you started, right?
Yeah.
To being a showrunner, how is that for you?
Yeah, so when I first met George, I was so nervous. Like, he's like my comedy icon. Like, he's like the first like Latino comedian I saw like up on stage, like speaking about, telling stories that I related to from my family. And so I just like he was like my hero. He is my hero. He's still my hero. I still pinch myself today that I get to work with him. So meeting him for the first time, I was just like so incredibly nervous. But as soon as I met him, like he's so down to earth. He's so real. He's so raw. And like I was like, oh, you're like one of my tios. Like I just feel like very connected to you. And he reminds me of my mom actually, weirdly. And so just like a force of nature just says what's on his mind. And the great thing about George Lopez and his comedy and is like he's speaking his truth. Like he's all his comedy comes from things he's experienced or his family's experience, and he knows what's funny about his pain. Like he knows what's funny about the hardships that he's gone through. And so he's like such a muse, and just like and so is Mayan. Mayan's inherited that same ability, that same insight into like what's, you know, what's funny about this painful thing that I'm going through, or I went through in the past. Usually it takes time to like reflect on it. In the moment, it's a little difficult.
On our show, we call that lava. Yeah, like the lava is the thing that your brain is trying to get you not to go towards because it feels very dangerous and like it'll burn you up. But in fact, it is the source of great, great writing. And of course, he and you have incredible skills even of and beyond accessing that. But that's the anchor of the show is so right. I think it's so, so special.
Yeah, it's their real story. I mean, they didn't speak for many years. And during the pandemic, they started talking again. And so I met them right in the middle of that, like right in the middle where they're mending their relationship. And so it was still in progress. It's still in progress today. And so it's a really interesting thing that there's like a show behind the show sort of happening where, you know, I'll be sitting with them and they might get into like a father-daughter tiff. And I'm like, oh, this is awkward. And then mine will be like, write it down, Debbie.
I was like, oh my God, quick, write it down.
Yeah. So we're very fortunate in that way that, you know, the actors on our show are actually living the show.
And inspiration.
Yeah, and sometimes we write things and then it happens in real life and vice versa. It's very weird. Like it's a very spiritual witchy experience.
It's amazing. What about one of our listeners, Sherry, asked about the transition from staffer to showrunner and what you learned or what do you have any insights into that?
Oh, gosh, nothing can prepare you for the showrunner position. Like people can train you, talk to you about it, but until you're in it, you're just like, you know, I think there was a writer, Liz Friedman, that like she's like, it's like being crushed by your dreams is what show running feels like. Because it's just like, yeah, you work so hard to get to this point, but then you're like, oh my God, this job is so overwhelming. I have so much. And you do so little writing too. That's the thing that no one talks about is like, you're out of the room during production. You're out of the room all the time. Like you try to do as much writing as you can in pre-production. We had 10 weeks this time before production. That was amazing. And we got, you know, 7 scripts done, which was incredible. But now I'm like trying to like find the time to get back in the room and break the others. But
what's one piece of advice you'd give somebody who's going to go run their first show? Just one piece. Anything.
One piece of advice that's going to run your first show. Have someone to talk to. Have someone that's done it before that you can call and ask them if everything's okay. And I have Bruce and I have Gloria Calderon Kellett and I have Mike Royce. So I have a number of people that I will text often and they will make me feel better. And they just remind you that like, yes, this is what it is. And everything's going to be okay.
I love that. And we all need that, right?
Mm-hmm.
We all need Absolutely. That. You need that one person because you're going down into that lava and you're doing something and you have a learning curve. And you're
yes.
Genius Lopez. I mean, it's like all the gifts are also in a way the challenges, right? All the, it's really, that's, you know, writing is a crazy thing. Charles asked if there is any sense of, is there any point in shooting a sizzle reel for a TV show idea he has?
Any point in shooting a sizzle reel? I think that can be helpful to have. I've heard of people selling pitches on sizzle reels, but you know, I think having a clear pitch is really what people want. You know, it's also every time I do a pitch, I do have visuals. Like I will have like sort of a PowerPoint presentation, and you know, I'll have like, you know, my dream actors in it, and you know, and I'll have like the setting, like I'll put pictures in for that. So having a visual component to your pitch is never a bad thing, but you want to leave room too, because they're going to want to have the input, and you don't want them to make, you don't want to make the network or studios feel like they can't have a say in what you're pitching.
No, it's really important, right? Because we all want control and to just have it all, not, you know, the feeling of control, to have it all completely nailed down. But somebody described it to me once, like, you don't want to build the Lego set without, they want to help you build the Lego set. Like they walk in and have built everything of this brand new Lego set and you can turn it around and show them every way you did it. They want to participate in what that Lego set will look like eventually.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. But the most important thing is that you're telling a story that's relatable and that people can connect to. Like, you know, what is the thing in your story that someone can connect? What is the human condition that you're exploring? Like figure out what that's at its core. Like that's what you need to know.
Yep.
We talk about that a
100%.
lot, Debbie, where like it's almost, I mean, I'd be curious when you were pitching, and I'm sure you also had George and Mayan in the room with you, but typically, even for a comedy show, like, did you guys start with the emotional juice before you kind of jumped into like the engine of the show? We talk about this on the podcast a lot, but we're rarely talking about network multicam. So I'd be curious to hear you speak to it.
Yeah, we definitely talked about their emotional journey and like what they went through. Like luckily we had a TikTok. So this show was born off of a TikTok that Mayan Lopez had posted where she's basically like talking about her parents' divorce and the big settlement her mom got and she's just working upside down. And so that was hilarious. Like already I was like, this is a show because obviously there's these unresolved issues between her and her father. And she's not afraid to call him out on it. And so we started with that. Like we showed them the TikTok and we talked about their journey, their ups and downs. And then we went to the comedy of it all.
Now, when you get to the comedy of it all, I have two questions on the comedy of it all. One is, Luke asked about comedy can be subjective. So when you're in the early stage, I know once you're hitting, table reads and audiences, it's not subjective anymore because either people are laughing or they're not. But when it's early on, he asked, how do you know if something is funny enough for the show, right? It's about making each other laugh, right? Or how do you know, okay, that's enough to go in, that you go in?
Yeah, I think like as you have a room, is your first test audience. So if everyone in the room is laughing, then you're like, okay, there's probably something here. And but if it, like I really push the room on jokes. I really take great pride in the jokes of this show, and that's like the most common like tweet that we get is about how funny it is. And I've never been a fan of a soft joke. I cannot stand a soft joke. I also hate straight lines. Sometimes they're necessary in a multicam, like you have to like ex have the exposition, but I hate straight lines. I like if you can make it into a joke, let's make it into a joke. And so if somebody pitches something in the room, or even me, I pitch a lot of stinkers too. We all do. And everyone's just like, huh. I'm like, that's not good enough. We all want to be rolling in our chairs for it to get in the script. So that's like the first test. And then
That's
when we do
always the
two,
best, right? Like
huh.
when you're in
Yeah.
the room at Pixar and somebody pitches what could happen, right? Like it usually grows. I don't know how it is in multicam, but I'll
Yeah.
throw out the stinker, which will then grab somebody else has an idea, and then I build on it and say, oh my God, he could do this. And then someone
Yeah.
goes, what if? And then we are on the ground. We are literally, we can't even speak. I'm just like, this is going in the movie. I don't know how we have to, I don't know how to put it in the movie, but it's gotta go in the movie.
Yeah, that's a very it's a very exciting part of the process when that happens and we're all on the same page and we're all like hive mind about what it is that we're doing. And what I find really funny is I live for this is when we all laugh at a joke in the room and then it plays in front of the audience and it bombs and no one laughs. I find that hysterical. I'm like, oh my God, this thing that we were just absolutely dying at in the room, nobody thinks it's funny or they think it's horrifying. Sometimes like there's like a, it was like too dark of a joke or whatever, didn't fly. And so what we do on the floor with multicam, which is really fun, is we'll huddle. And we'll pitch, and so we'll come up with an alt joke right there on the floor, and then we'll run it into the actor, and they'll do it, and then
No,
hopefully
it's
you
so
save
fun to be in the
it.
audience for that and to watch the creativity happen right in front of you. If you're in LA and you're trying to spec multicams, I hope you've gone to a bunch to watch the pros at work. Now, another writer and friend of mine, Megan, asked about that she heard a multicam creator talk, I believe at Austin or somewhere, where they just talked about how some rooms, comedy rooms, can be brutal. They can be very competitive. And they're one of the hardest rooms to be in. And she said, that made me never want to write on multicam. And that made me sad because she's super funny. So I was just wondering, how do you as a showrunner encourage that kind of fun one-upmanship, like, building on a joke without it becoming negative, without it becoming about tearing down something?
I think it all stems from the top. And I think things are changing because of the Me Too movement and all that. Like, I think those old school rooms that were brutal in the past, like, kind of don't exist anymore because I love the younger generation and how they speak up, like, and how they call people out. And so
Yeah,
I
they
think
don't
there's
put up
like,
with any of that, do
yeah, they
they?
don't put up with any of that. So it kind of doesn't fly anymore. I think it's like a fear that young writers don't have to have. Like, I was speaking recently at SCAD Film Festival and I was like, oh, I was in a room once that was toxic because I was the only woman in the room and it was all men and like it would get very like uncomfortable very quickly and like because the alpha male was toxic and so all the other males felt like they had to like go along with it and I was just sitting there just so uncomfortable and I would cry in my office and I'm like this is awful and I was telling this young group of students about it and one of the women asked a question. She's like, what do I do if I'm in that situation? I'm in a room with all men. How am I not going to feel down? And I'm like, don't worry. I don't think that that's not the norm anymore,
Yeah.
And, I was on a panel with like eight female showrunners. And I think females in lead in power positions are, I think, the best. No offense to the men in this room. But there's a lot more empathy, I think, now in comedy than there was in the past.
I love that. I'm so glad to hear that. I wanted to make sure we get to the questions about the biggest challenge writers face within the industry that are, Latinx. Like, what's that specifically? Is there another hurdle do you feel, or is that also changing?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge is that there's not enough Latine representation at the executive level. So there's not really a passion and a push for our stories to be told, and that's unfortunate. And I hope that there's more people out there, listeners, that want to go the executive route, because we need those people. We need our people in power positions and decision-making positions. Because like if you don't really relate to something, you're not really gonna want to green light it, honestly. But ultimately, it's definitely like we're lacking representation, but I try not to focus on that. I'm trying to focus on the now, and how can I change things now? I'm very blessed to have this show that survived a pandemic, that survived a strike. And I'm using it as an opportunity to hire, as many Latine like crew, writers, talent as I can. Because like I know that if I do that, they can rise up the ranks and they can join me in my fight, to make more Latine representation behind the screen and in front of it.
And what you do so beautifully on your show is the prism goes back to the, like, as you said, the human condition, right? Which is so beautiful. And a lot of writers have questions about writing characters that fall outside of their own cultural experience. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I think if you're gonna attempt that, you should definitely should get to know someone from that cultural experience. Like sit down and really do a deep dive and ask them questions, and I wouldn't tell a complete story from a different culture's perspective if you don't come from that perspective. It's like that's a little bit of a no-no. But maybe you can partner with somebody from that culture, so that it's authentic and it's accurate. Because if you don't, it's not gonna be right.
It's been so wonderful to have you here. We always end with the same three questions for every guest. So I'm going to ask you now. The first is, what brings you the most joy when it comes to writing?
What brings me the most joy when it comes to writing?
Or show running?
I think it's that moment when you're in the flow. What Oprah talks a lot about being in the flow. That is like the just such a amazing moment. Like we talked about it earlier, like when it happens in the room as well. Like when everyone's just on the same page, or like when you're writing alone in your room and you're like, I have something. Like just that, like this is really good. Like that feeling, like I think there's no better feeling.
It is amazing.
And then
Go ahead.
the flip side of that is what pisses you off about writing?
That it's so hard. It's like it's so hard. It hurts my brain. It's like by the end of the day, like I have like nothing left in me. Like I just have to watch Housewives at the end of the
Okay, this
day.
is important. Which ones are you watching? What are your go-to franchises?
I love Miami because it's my Latinas, and I come from there, so I love it. And then I'm also do Beverly Hills, and then I heard I need to watch Salt Lake, but I haven't gotten to it
It's
yet.
wild. Yeah,
Yeah.
it is.
Okay, now I have to watch this show.
Yes, I love that you're keeping it in the NBCU family too, Debbie. That's great. Yes. The
Yes.
executives listening are
Yeah.
happy. The peacock is happy, yes.
Peacock. Subscribe to Peacock. You can watch season two
Yeah.
of Lopez on it.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, the last question is, if you could have coffee with your younger self, what piece of advice would you tell that Debbie?
My younger self. I would tell her, to not give up, that it's going to be very challenging. There's going to be ups and downs, but I think if I met my younger self, I would understand that I had a deep, deep passion for it. Like, and that's something you have to have. Like, if you don't have like a deep love and passion for television or film, you won't make it. 'Cause like, you just won't. If there's something else that you think you could do, go do that. But if you have that deep passion, then don't give up, because if you keep at it and keep, and definitely, like, I think of writing like it's like you have to approach it like a sport. Like, you gotta like practice, you gotta write bad script after bad script to write the good script. So keep practicing.
I love that comparison, because of course, if you walked up to a novice and handed them a giant pole and said, use this pole to vault over that
Yeah.
6 foot, you'd be like, what? I can't do that. I need to practice. I need to learn how to do that. And people just don't understand that writing is exactly the same.
Yeah, it's a skill.
It's a skill. It's amazing. Thank you so much for being here. I
Thank
loved
you for having me.
having the opportunity to get inside your brain, your genius brain, and learn all about the multicam and how you see things. It was really, really fun.
Thank you. I really enjoyed speaking with you. And if listeners, you can catch the first season of Lopez versus Lopez on Netflix. And
Ooh.
second season will be out April 2nd.
And do catch it. Even if you don't want to write multicam, please go watch it, because watch great writing. Just watch what she's doing. It's really, you'll learn. You'll learn, and you'll also have a great time.
Oh, thank you so much, Meg.
Thanks so much for joining us on today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, learned a ton, and so glad that you could join us. And remember, you are not alone, and keep writing.